The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2010 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2010. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
By way of introduction, for those who don't know me, my name is David Goodwin. I left my job in the business world about 6 years ago to run the Ambrose School in Boise. It says Meridian on our tags and stuff, but that's just a suburb. So we're in Boise. Used to be Foundations Academy. I spent a lot of years working on business modeling and strategic planning in the corporate world, working for HP. Did several consulting gigs with other companies as well. And the only thing they let me talk on at the ACCS is business for that reason. Someday they'll ask me to talk on Plato, but it'll be a sad day. For you, not for me. I'd love to, but I just don't know that stuff as well as I know the business. I'm kind of easing into this a little bit here. One thing I have to say, my background was in marketing. So I came into strategic management in HP through the marketing side. Some people come in through finance, some people come in through engineering, you know, what have you. I came in through marketing, so most of what you'll get from me may be a little bit different than what you've seen from past or other strategic planning or business planning kinds of activities because of that kind of, we grow from the roots wherever we were planted, and that's where I grew up from. Can everybody hear me all right at this point? Kind of sketchy? Well, I'm not Mr. AV, so I'll just try and talk louder. Anyway, one thing, being from the marketing side of things, that I really want to caveat here is that when you do business planning from a marketing perspective or from the market perspective, it depends a lot on your local market. And most of you are probably not in my situation. In fact, probably unless you're running a classical Christian school in Boise, Idaho, you are not faced with the same exact challenge as I am. So most of what you'll hear today, what I'd like you to do is just try and take from it an idea that you can apply in your own markets, but don't assume that it's going to be similar to ours. By way of introduction to that, I wanted to say a little bit about Boise, my home. I grew up there, went to school outside of Boise, but other than that, pretty much have been there most of my life. And one of the things, for those of you who were at my speeches last year, you already heard this story, but I'd encourage you to really understand the cultures where you are, because a lot of times that is going to drive your business plan. And the culture where we are is interesting. I would put it Rome circa 600 BC. And what I mean by that is it's very – Boise doesn't have much of a culture. Most of your roads here in Raleigh-Durham, if any of you are from here, are older than our entire state. So there isn't really a depth of culture in Idaho that you would find out here. And as I talk to people, I really realize some of that and how that flows through to how we position ourselves in the community and what people value and what we do. So, for example, Boise's history, and this is an important thing to understand for each of your communities, probably 2 out of 3 or 3 out of 4 Boiseans are California transplants. So they've moved up from California, usually fleeing the regulatory environment, so they're conservatives, but they don't have a strong anchor to the area. And with that much influx and that much of an influx of people, all kinds of cultures are brought in with that. Boise was a whistle stop along, and it wasn't even a whistle stop. I guess you'd have to have a train, and we didn't even have trains for, I think, till the 1900s sometime. It was a mining community. It fed mining camps in the mountains. It was a stop along the Oregon Trail. As I mentioned last year, I like to think of it as Quittersville, because when you came across the death trap that was southern Idaho's desert and on the Oregon Trail, it was the only place, it was the first tree that you had seen in 250 miles was in Boise. So we became the city of trees. It's kind of funny because if you ever see a picture of Boise, I tried to find one to put up here, there aren't that many trees. Most of you here in North, if any of you are from this area, would laugh at the idea that we're the city of trees. It's a desert with a tree. But, you know, as Doug's fond of saying, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. So Boise became the stop where people would say, you know, this isn't the Willamette Valley in Oregon, this isn't the promised land, but it's close enough, we're going to stay here. And that formed our early culture, highly pragmatic, not very easy to, you know, these aren't people who work, you know, strive to work. The family nature of the town has come around in about the last 30 years. So what I face, marketing-wise, in the city that we're in, is a city that does not have a strong academic ethic. I was talking to another headmaster here an hour ago, and he was talking about how his school is characterized by people who want to get their kids into good colleges, and he, you know, he's struggling with that and trying to adjust to that. I just wish any of our parents cared about that kind of thing. I mean, it's more an optimist football kind of a place, not even competitive football, just optimist football. So when you get into Boise, you have to understand that that's where all this is going to come from. And two other initial points here. That long URL can be avoided if you just I chose not to do handouts this year because you can get this information and a lot more for both of my talks just straight off our website at the school. You can go to www.theambroseschool.com will take you there too, but theambroseschool.org, and go into our document library and pull this down. It's in the general section, or you can copy that long URL. There is a password on it. I didn't want the parents to know what I was telling you, so I password protected it, and it's ACCS2010, lowercase. So let's see if I've got range here. Oh, I do. So to begin with, there's a few things that I learned in the business world that might, you know, some of this, it's always hard with audiences to know exactly where to begin, because some of you may be, I found out last year in my talks, there were people in the room, and I will guarantee it again this year, who know more about this than I do. And so I'm trying to hit the middle there. So if I'm reviewing stuff that seems obvious, just take that caveat, and I apologize for it. There's some ways in which our schools are like other businesses. And my goal today is really to start down a path that I'm going to finish tomorrow. Today is much more strategic in nature. Tomorrow's talk is more on practical kind of, these are things we do to build parent appreciation of classical education in the environment that I just told you about. So today's talk is really more focused on some of the business modeling you have to do before you get there to figure that out. The first point on here, tuition is set by the market given by the value you provide, given the value that you provide. This is a point we're going to hit on a few times in here, and it really ties to affordability. And when the ACCS asked me to speak on this, I realized that I had to think about why things happen the way they do in my school, and I made some assumptions that we're going to test a little bit, and I hope to get you all involved here near the end. Another one that I learned while I was at HP, we had a saying, you know, it's much easier to keep a customer than to get a new one. So do what you can to keep your own families. And so we're going to talk a bit about that. That's almost a platitude in the business world. And so if you're from the business world, I apologize. And resources enable excellence. This is something we've realized as we've grown up. The Ambrose School is, we have about 415 students right now. We built our own building last year. We've seen a measure of success. We have a great teaching staff. We've been able to recruit teachers from some excellent colleges recently. But I grew up with the school. I was a board member 15 years ago. I took over running the school 6 years ago. And so I've been through all life stages up till where we are presently at. And one of the things that I have learned in that is that as much as We definitely should never despise small beginnings, as we often say. Having resources helps. It's been amazing moving into our new building. One of the things that we found anecdotally was that, this is just a little detail, those maps you buy for classrooms are very, the CRAM maps are very expensive, and the 65-inch plasma displays dropped in price to where we could buy one of those for what the map sets were costing us, so we put those in. And it's been fascinating to see how the teachers have used those this year. We don't, you know, we have some restrictions. We don't teach by video. But, you know, watching our chemistry teacher rotate molecules on the screen and do things like that, I mean, it's a good thing to have resources. And so what I want to do is encourage you all to work towards that end, realizing that a lot of times resources are what drive excellence. The Lord will bless in any circumstance. It's an odd talk to be doing in an economy like ours, but I think we've continued to grow through the economy, and we've seen that in other classical schools around the country, so I think it's a positive time for us if we just take hold of the opportunity. There's a couple of things that are unique about schools, and I don't want to miss these. It was always funny to start a strategic planning session in the business world, because maximizing shareholder wealth is always the answer. And I got a little tired of it. but you didn't have to ask what the purpose of your organization was. Your schools are different, and your goals are all related to classical education, but clearly you're mission-driven. You're driven by your mission. So you got to know that mission, and you got to have that vision. And that's kind of outside the purview of the talk, but I would encourage you to work on that if you haven't already. There's a lot we could say about that. The other thing is that sometimes when we're wandering around in the world, we tend to take our experiences in and make that apply to everything. So when you see marketing at Target or at Walmart, you think, oh, maybe that'd be a good idea for my school. If any of you are in the business, you know that there's two kinds of marketing. There's marketing for consumer goods, and there's marketing for high cost items. If you're selling jets, you are not doing it with advertisements in the newspaper. You have a sales force, you have materials, you're set up to do to sell $5 million jets. And selling classical education is more like selling a $5 million jet than it is trying to sell what you see in the newspaper. So be careful where you're getting your marketing cues from. First thing that I want to encourage you to do is identify, I was just going to make mention of this, your typical family. And we're going to go into some research that I did earlier. If any of you helped me with that research, thank you. And so first, I want to talk a little bit about healthy financial models. Before you can do a strategic plan, you have to know what your plan for stability is. And sometimes it's really part of the strategic planning process. I'm going to give you a quick example, and before I put it up, well, I'll throw it up here so you can not listen to me and pay attention to the numbers. This is just ours. This is not yours. Again, this depends very much on your market. And some of you are going to look at ours and go, man, they don't charge much for tuition, or wow, you don't have many students in your classes, or you have too many students in your classes. That's not what I'm pointing out. I've found in these sessions over the years that I learn more from examples of other people's organizations and I can apply them to my own. So just take it for that. Please don't take this and try and make it apply to yours. So a sustainable model, you guys, this may be somewhat obvious, but you just have to get your total tuition revenue and divide it by your number of students. And remember to do this on a macro budget level. Don't assume your tuition is what you're making per student. It's never the case. You have to divide, you know, by the discounts and all that. So for us, that's about $3,800. We actually charge about $5,200 in, you know, per student at the top end of what we charge. But when you get all the discounts in there and take out the unpaid tuition and other things, it gets down to about $3,800. You just divide that, take your average tuition, divide it by your number of students, multiply it by your class size, and you're going to get a number that's going to tell you roughly what revenue you would ideally pick up if you filled every class in your school, which in our case is about $76,000 per class. Then if you figure what your hard cost of your teacher is, in our case, loaded, it's about $38,000, you get to about 50%. And I've seen as I've consulted with other schools that this is fairly uniform. And it seems odd that your teacher's only making about half of what you're bringing in for that. But I've looked at it time and time again, and it's valid because you really have to pay your overhead. You can't cut back on your overhead. This might actually be a little bit understated on the overhead because of the way our school is a very low overhead school because of the economic pressure in our market. So, and then you have to look at this comment I make here. Beware of expansion. A lot of schools that I've seen will double their grades as soon as they have six or seven students overlapping, too many students in one class. And there's a lot of schools of thought on how to accomplish going from one class per grade to two classes per grade, but we did it the wrong way, which is as soon as we had a few extra students, we threw open another class, and then we suffered for the next 5-6 years. Other schools have done it by waiting, and their waiting list effectively becomes a depressant. Nobody thinks they can get in the school, so nobody tries, and it'll depress your enrollment. So you got to hit somewhere in between the two where you allow a class to grow to maybe 25, and then you wait until you have 5 or 6 on the waiting list, and you can get at least up to 32. But you've got to know where your break even is, and you've got to be committed to your direction. Don't just open it in one grade and not in another, and it's all kind of mixed. You got to start from the bottom and work up usually, but just be real careful of that. Hiring and retention of talent. One thing that is unique about our business is that most people are in it for the passion of it, and so that's a paycheck that we don't have to write. And I don't like that. I prefer that we pay people a market value, but at least at this point we are striving as a school to get to the point where we can pay a livable wage to heads of household in our school area. And some of you I know are at that or beyond it. It's just a challenge of being in the market that we're in. Now I'm going to get on to kind of the main meat of what we're talking about in this session, which is selling value. I talked already about the high investment sales process. And what I mean by that is some schools will spend money on advertising in newspapers, broadcasting, billboards, that kind of thing, and then not spend money on the packets that you send out to parents. And that's the inverse of what you should be doing. The high-touch sales process, and I saw Kerry Christian's system earlier this week. It's excellent the way they walk students through a process or walk families through a process. It doesn't fit for us exactly, but I learned a lot from it, and I think that whatever you do, you need a process that there are people involved. You're returning phone calls from somebody who can actually maybe knows enough about the school to be able to answer questions. You get them in the door. You walk them through the process. So put your energy into that part of your marketing, into the marketing materials. Most of our marketing materials are on that website that I gave you. In that, they're crunched up in a PDF in there. So if you want to look at ours, you can see them. But the second point here that I wanted to make is value, and this is one of the tough points to make. So I'm going to use a brief illustration here. But before I do that, some of the research that we did, this was an interesting point, and I'm going to step away from the mic here and try and talk loud enough.
If you notice here, this was the national survey that I did for this presentation. We have a lot of classical Christian schools. We had about 350 total respondents. But if you look at this, the majority of this is a big chunk of non-denominational. That's where they're going to church. But there's a lot of Presbyterians running these things. We're being taken over by Presbyterians.
Actually, I go to a PCA church, so it's pointing back at ourselves. But remember, our customers are not us, all right? So you need to look at who you're bringing in and understand them and not assume that they're just like you. So that's what I wanted to bring out in this. And I wanted to tie this to Scripture just to be clear. This concept of value is clear in the parable of the man who bought the field. If you remember, the parable is pretty simple in Matthew 13, where a man finds a treasure, he covers it back up, and then he goes and buys the field. And the concept of value is right there. That man walking by that field before he found the treasure didn't really care. He wouldn't have spent any money on that field. He didn't really want it. The owner of that field didn't price it correctly. He didn't know the treasure was there either. The man sells all that he can, sells all that he has, and buys the field. Why does he do that? Because his understanding of the value of that field is greater than the guy who owned it. And so the concept of value that we see in Scripture here is that when a parent tells you they can't afford something, they can't afford your tuition, it probably means they don't value your school enough. There are people who cannot afford tuition, but very few people cannot afford open heart surgery if they need it, right? So the bottom line is, it's not always the money that's driving these decisions. It's the value that the customer puts into it or the parent puts into it. So if we look at understanding value, this is a question I know that's probably all near and dear to a lot of our hearts. Why can some parents go on an $8,000 family vacation every year and say they can't afford your school, and others are living in a 1,600-square-foot house with and manage to pay for it when a family of four in a 4,000-square-foot house can't afford it, right? That's tied to the concept of value. What they value is not classical Christian education. They value a 4,000-square-foot house, or they value a vacation. They don't value classical Christian education. So the answer isn't to lower our prices. The answer is to increase the perceived value for those customers. And the key here is not to judge them, right? I was there. I had the 4,000-square-foot house in the suburb. I actually still have it because I can't seem to get rid of it in this market. But in the process of moving up through the American system before I caught the bug for classical Christian education, that's where you're at. You know, but for the grace of God go we, right? So I think it's imperative not to judge these people, but rather to help them see the value that they don't see right now, to help the man uncover the treasure so that he can go out and sell all that he has in order to buy the field. And so with that concept, I'm going to move to this chart here. It's really a simple concept. Our tuition's around $5,000 a year. All I have to do to get a family to buy at that price is to get them to appreciate our school enough to sacrifice for it, regardless of how much money they make. It doesn't matter if they make $40,000 a year or $100,000 a year. So in our market, it so happens that the median income in Boise is about $44,000 a year. And this is stuff you should look up on your own. Now, remember, median incomes include McDonald's, you know, 17-year-olds and everything else. So really, we have calculated our median income for a family of two or three at about $65,000-$70,000 a year. And so that's the bottom end of our targeted pricing so that we can get families who make the right sacrifices in. And then we have financial aid for those that fall below that. Now, we just started that. It's not something we do very well yet, but it's the model we're trying to move towards is figure out those who truly are going to have to make Herculean sacrifices to be at the school. And we have a few of those. We have a painter who every year puts his tuition on his credit card, and then because in the summer he paints more, he can work a certain number of extra days and work at night and pay off his credit card. And so, you know, those kind of things are heart-wrenching to watch, but it's also a joy to watch how much somebody values your school. That particular man has a sophomore in our school now, and she's, you know, salt of the earth, great girl. You can get your best students from these tough financial situations. You just have to help them understand how to get there. So value shift over time. One thing about value that we notice at our school, how many of you in here have have a larger grammar school than you do a secondary school? How many have a larger secondary than you do a grammar? Okay. So, good. I targeted the right audience. I figured some of you might be like us. Sorry, sir. We'll have to. This isn't for you as much. But why does that happen? So we've done, that's what this research was, we did, was trying to answer, is why does that happen? And I think any of you who are headmasters probably know, because you've worked in that. This is what I have noticed anecdotally, and it's confirmed by some of the evidence. First off, when we get a first or kindergartner in, safety is a big concern. They want to know, do you keep them under control all the time? They love to see the control that we have in the classroom. Obviously, when you're 17, it's a different kind of safety you're worried about. So that changes. Small class sizes become less of a concern as kids get older. Christian community becomes more centered around the church and youth groups. So this is the community factor. It's not a bad thing. It's just a truth that, you know, in the fourth grade, everybody at the birthday party is somebody from school. In the 11th grade, if you have any kind of a party, it's a bunch of kids from the soccer club or whatever else, right? So part of the challenge we have is that the community shifts for a lot of these kids. Children become more independent participants in the process. We've all seen this. This is something that I had a conversation with someone else here at the conference that seems to be a growing trend, where basically a kid goes to school where they want to go to school. And that is that's going to be a problem for us, because it's not always evident what our value is to a 14-year-old eighth grader or a 13-year-old eighth grader. There's this odd thing that as you age, you start concerning yourself more with retirement and college than you did when your kindergartner was there. And so another problem I think we face is that parents start to worry about the money more the closer they get to retirement and college. So they look for opportunities to use the public schools for high school. Last one there is perceptions about academic quality change. And this is one where we're always battling. Because big high schools have lots of options, that can be a problem. So let's look at the research here a little bit. I'm going to step away here. Try and do my best to project. One thing to notice here is that the orange and the blue, the top two, are the things that were listed as the most important or second most important thing. Right? So this was a forced ranking. You had to rank the values. Your choices were the question was, given the goals you have for your child, how would you prioritize these investments? And the choices were K-6, grade 7-8, grades 9 to 12, college, providing opportunities for travel and discovery. Believe it or not, that got a vote or two. Programs, sports, lessons for the child, and financial inheritance I leave my child. I threw all kinds of crazy things up here just to see what would come out. And, you know, in this list, I got what I was thinking. The priority was K through 6 is the most important. 7-8 is the second, and high school is the third. So the perception of families is it gets less important to be in a classical Christian school the older your kid is, right? That's no surprise to any of you who raised their hands. So let's look at what step back over here. Thinking of high schools for your children, which of the following statements represent a persuasive reason for you to place your student in a public charter school? Now, remember, we were surveying mostly classical Christian people in your schools. Now, you might ask, why did you do that? They're already in our schools. Well, there's a concept in marketing that you always go to look at who's currently in, who is your customer today, to figure out who will be your customer tomorrow, because more people like that tend to come to your school. So you want to find these people, even if they're in your community, right, that aren't in your school yet, or build them one way or the other. And if you look at these high areas here, where you see the gold and the blue, these are the ones that are most persuasive, all right? So if I can keep myself upright, the most important were that public schools are persuasive when they have extracurricular activities, are better, varied and specialized classes, better resourced, so there's a perception that public high schools are better resourced, and more academic choices. So that's kind of no-brainer, right? That's all stuff we kind of know. But we're leading up to something, so I wanted to bring out the research that we used to make some of these, or draw some of these conclusions. Yes?
Will you explain once more who was surveyed again, or how you did this survey?
Right. I sent the survey out to all the headmasters of classical Christian schools, and some of them, a small handful, chose to send it to their families through the email. And the survey was conducted online, and so it's not a scientific survey because I couldn't get enough respondents. There's 34,000, and we got about 340 respondents total. But it's better than a poke in the eye with a sharp stick. So another element we see is that students gain a voice in this, right? They have friends in other places, extracurricular connections. Does anybody else encounter the eighth grade discontentment year? It's like you couldn't make it. I was going around being pretty judgmental about all these grumbly eighth graders, and then I thought back to my eighth grade year, and I switched schools in my eighth grade year of my own accord because I was grumbling. So I can't really blame them. But nonetheless, that's a bad, you know, that's something we have to address. Prefer less work to more. Imagine a student or a child preferring less work to more. I'm guilty of that occasionally, too. And then they perceive grades as success. This is an odd one that I've run into before where parents want to, you know, the verbiage I hear is, well, I just want my child to experience more success than they're having at your school. Well, they're getting C's and B's here. Yeah, well, they could get straight A's in the public schools. And so, you know, there's this idea that they need to feel successful. And so then we look at these economic factors. We already talked about that, really. So then what can we do? And I hope I don't leave you too disappointed here because there are only so many answers. Tomorrow I'm going to go through what we actually do in my presentation tomorrow. But today I just want to look at some of the ideas that we can pursue. One thing is we can build on our strengths. So you look at a survey and you'll get two things, what they don't like about you and what they do like about you. And you just have to find ways to connect things that you're strong on. So one of the highest, if you look at this category, obviously it's an outlier, it's really high. That answer was the integration of academic subjects in a biblical worldview. In the free text form, our Christian side of what we do is by far the most sellable to parents. And so whatever you do when you're talking about, some of us can easily over-assume. I had Doug Wilson speak at our school last week, and I had parents come up to me afterwards and go, I never heard about the Trivium. And I'm supposed to be speaking at the conference on how to get your parents to understand classical Christian education, right? So, you know, a humbling fact is we forget that the core message is oftentimes the one that needs to be said. And we do a lot. You've probably seen, some of you may have seen the Discover book that we publish. I do a lot with parent communication, but we still, it was that parent, I walked over to the rack and pulled our Discover book out, opened it to the center page and said, here, you know, read. We sent this to you several times. But the point is that you have to really analyze where you're at and see if you're really even hitting the basics. The second one on here, so the biblical worldview integration, it was a really, really high one. So I would encourage you to create messages around that. The second one, which was lower, was positive peer influences. That's hard to message because you don't want to message a negative. You don't want to say, and you don't want to message something that's untrue. You can't say you're not gonna have any sin at our school, right? And you can't say those sinners across the street. So we actually have an alternative high school across the street from our location, so it's easy to do. You have to, you know, be positive. I mean, the positive things are we've got great kids here. Come check us out. Come walk through our halls. See if they don't smile at you and speak more maturely and more, you know, and that's another thing. Marketing can't cover substance. So one thing I want to really emphasize is, you know, if you don't have the substance, you don't have anything to sell. So what we want to do is we want to get you to the point where what you're saying is effectively communicating what you are. And so that's the goal here. The third one, Bible teaching and instruction. Like I said, these Christian elements are really up. So actual specific instruction, not integrated worldview, but specific instruction is the third highest. And then strong academics are the fourth. One thing about strong academics is that we had another slide. And by the way, I included a lot more research stuff in that packet online. So obviously I've only got an hour here. But in fact, all the data is out there as well. One of the things about strong academics is you have to quantify that and message around that more carefully, because some parents think strong academics are an AP class and others think Latin. So we have to figure that out, and there's some of that in the research, but really your best source of information for that is how many of you headmasters actually interview every incoming family? Okay, good. You should be if you didn't raise your hand, I believe. Because first off, you're the gatekeeper. And there's nothing more important, maybe except teachers at your school, than who you let in. So being a gatekeeper is a critical and vital mission. But the other thing is, it's a mining time. You can mine, okay, you get it. What is it about our communication that got you? What do you like about what you saw in our materials? And the chances are you do that a few dozen times and you're going to understand your parents better. And so I would really encourage you to do that. Now on to the bad news. We should expect some losses, and I'm going to talk a little bit about our business model around that. These were some comments. I know they may be hard to read, so I'm going to read them out here. I just asked parents to mark whether they agreed or disagreed with some of these statements. Education is important, but there are lots of good schools. In the long run, it will not make much difference where my child goes to school. So I wanted to see, well, 10% agreed with that. All right? That's 10% of students at classical Christian schools. You're going to lose them. If they think that way, you're probably going to lose them. Hard academic work is important, even if it means some struggles at home for my child. 13% disagreed with that. So they don't want any hard work for the kids. They could have chosen neutral if they thought, well, I don't mean too bad or too much or too little. But they chose that they disagreed with that. 13%. By the time my student is in the 8th or 9th grade, he or she is old enough to have a say in where he or she wants to go to high school. Obviously, even I might say that I'd like my child to have some say, but I just wanted to feel out where parents were on this. I'm not going to listen to her, but at least I want her to know that I'm looking like I listen. 16% of the people agreed with this statement. So what does this tell us? Plan for attrition. One of the things that in our school, we aren't one of those schools that's full all the way up through. And so my solution is I've either got to come up with a business model, and we're coming back to the business model that I talked about at first. I've either got to come up with a business model that plans for attrition, or I've got to let anyone and everyone who walks through the door in my school when they're in high school or in junior high, right? And that is not where any of us want to be. So design your business model for attrition. So this is ours, airing the dirty laundry of the Ambrose School here. This is 2006 to 2010, and those colored blocks describe the student counts in each of those grades as they travel through. So our sixth grade in 2006 had 29, yeah. Then it dropped, 29 or 23, it's 23, okay. It dropped to 24, went up to 24, then to 28, then back down to 22 and 23. And so what you're doing is following a single class through our school to see where it's at. You need to create one of these charts for your school if you haven't, because you need to know when and where you're losing students. Now, it would have been better if I could have said how many came and went, but we didn't keep that data, so I can't really tell you that. But as a net number, this is what we lost. And when you look at between the 8th and 9th grade, we lost 27% in 2007, 14% in 2008, 21% in 2009 and 16% in 2010. So what do we learn from this? Well, I learned two things. One is I need to communicate our value better so that we don't lose parents if we can help it. But I need to business plan so that we aren't pie in the sky hoping for 40 kids in those grades and then struggling when we don't get them, because that forces bad behavior when you have to accept kids that really shouldn't be accepted in at these late times. So our total 6th through 12th grade attrition is between 16 and 20%, 15 and 20%, somewhere in there. And we hope to bring that down to around 10%, but we're not going to do it by compromising. We're going to do it by communicating. And that's a lot of what I'm talking about tomorrow. But there's a few ideas here. I didn't want to leave you kind of cliffhanging, and I wanted to make it a contained session so you didn't have to come back. Few ideas. We're just working on this one, so it's truly in the idea category. But adopt a discipleship strategy to establish a core of parents. This is one thing that we're really driving hard right now, is that a couple years ago I heard Matt Whitling's talk on idols, and I realized that in education, John Dewey and his ilk have created idols that we worship on a daily basis without even knowing it. And one of those is that a classroom looks like this. It has a chalkboard at the front of it, has a teacher standing there, and it has 20 desks lined in an array. It has a name or a label like eighth grade, and that's what education looks like. But Jesus didn't have any of those things. He didn't have chalkboards. He didn't have seats in a classroom. He had men that were around him in groups of three, groups of 12, groups of 60 or 70 when you're dealing with the disciples that he sent out, and, of course, masses. And so we need to look at education differently and disciple those students. So I'm working because I believe if a student has a personal connection with their teachers that is not this wall that Dewey wanted to build between the industrialized student sitting in the seat and the lofty teacher standing in front, and we bring it down. This is not a situation where you lower the level of respect required or lower your standards. It's just get your environment to be more discipleship and relational, just like Christ was, tying into your parents and your students, and this is speaking specifically of parents, in a discipleship format where you train the 12 and they go out and they continue to spread that within your community. This is the hardest one of any to do, but then that's typical of the Christian life. The thing that we're called to is often the hardest thing. And so we will move on to the second one, which is shift the parents to new values. These are some value ideas. These are not messages. So in the marketing world, we have values and we have messages. Values are kind of stating blandly what it is we want them to get, and messages are how we communicate that. And so the message is very tied to who your target customer is. And like I said at the beginning, your target customer is different than my target customer. In my discussions, I see Larry standing in the back there with Kerry Christian. He's in a very different market here. He's got a lot of very good prep schools in the area from which, you know, he's won. And so the market for him is much more of a high academic market. For some of us, you know, my town, it's a evangelical family kind of affair. The people aren't impressed by academics. They don't care too much about that. So you have to message those things differently. And so I'm not going to give you messages. I'm giving you values. Education for the free. This is a tough one, but it's basically saying that your kids come out with an independence of mind. Now, of course, we want it captive to Christ, and that's a big factor, and we're going to talk more about that tomorrow. But there is this, you know, the Euripides, only the educated are free. It's kind of the concept that we're not Dewey. We aren't crunching out socialists out of our back door on an assembly line through a conveyor belt. We're giving the kids the tools of learning so they can know who they are in Christ, and they can be independent thinkers. The second, that one, this, by the way, these were driven by the research, looking at what parents value. That ties to that integrated Christian worldview. Clear thinking, writing, and speaking is an irreplaceable asset in the job market. Well, I don't like pragmatic approaches to validating classical education any more than the next guy, but I still get people. So is my kid going to come out of here hopelessly inert in the world, unable to, and they judge that by jobs. I worked in business for a long time, and I watched a lot of presentations, and I watched them rise and fall, $400 million decisions on a quarterly basis in the company that I worked for were rising and falling on how convincing somebody was in front of a group of people. And we've got to let people know that classical education builds leaders that can stand up in front of a CEO as easily as they can stand up in front of the teleprompter at, you know, at a big conference or as the President of the United States. That skill is universal, and that's an area you can really work on messaging. Owning your faith versus knowing your faith. I work on this one with parents. You know, you can tell your kids everything you want them to know, but until they own it, until they have wrestled with it and they understand it, they aren't going to fully appreciate the grace and truth of the gospel. So you really, you know, that's a big value for us, is teaching kids how to own their faith versus just knowing what it is. And this is a big deal because a lot of parents have watched their kids. We have a great contingent in our school of grandparents who are raising their kids' grandkids, who bring them to our school because their kids weren't given this thing and they realized the damage it caused, right? So they didn't own their faith. They knew their faith. They sent them to XYZ Christian school. They knew their faith. They went out. They had made bad life decisions, like some of our students will, but the point being, they come to us because they realize that owning faith is different than knowing it. Worldviews are not worldviews are transferred, not taught. This is a concept we really have to work on, and that ties back to discipleship that I was mentioning earlier. I always laugh when I see ACSI school or something. I'm not down on ACSI schools, but they have a worldview class in their high school. And that to me is, some of you may have one, and I'm sorry if I'm digging it, but a worldview class is a bit of an anathema to me because I don't understand, everything. American Lit should be your worldview class. English Lit is a worldview class because it's all under the subjection of Jesus Christ. And so that's one of the things I deal with. The richness of life when you actually have read poetry, when you've read Dante. Some of you heard one of my students this morning talking on poetry, and I think that's a key message we need to get out there, is that life is a rich place, and everything isn't about money. In fact, nothing really is about money. And so that's a message we need to figure out how to get out there. The leadership message, the persuasion message I already talked about. So this plays a little bit, I'm down to end here and I think I'm at the end of my time. This plays on the seven laws of teaching a little bit, in saying, first off, how do you build new value for your parents? Well, learning as a parent is the same thing as learning as a kid in some respects. It stills the seven laws, right? You got to take them from a known to an unknown. You can't talk to parents starting with Plato, because they don't know Plato. And you can't talk to parents about ethereal concepts of truth, goodness, and beauty, because they don't understand, beauty is something foreign to most modern minds. So you've got to build bridges with your messages. You've got to start with something they care about in your message and go to something that's important. Use language consistent with today's worldview. A lot of the terminology we use in the classical Christian realm is really more targeted at ourselves. It's stuff we believe in, but I'm not sure parents are going to understand the language. And then I mentioned coming to tomorrow's thing because that's where the specific examples are. If you can't come to that, by the way, the slides are in the deck that's on the internet that I mentioned earlier. So conclusions. First, address weak areas. Build a social environment in 7 through 12. These are some practical things. Really focus on that social environment there. If the kids love each other and love the good, love the standard, if you can just achieve that, you're going to hold retention, because the only ones you're going to lose are the ones you want to lose, the ones who won't play the game, right? What's painful to me, we lose, you know, as I mentioned, 6-7 kids a year out of some of these classes. I only mourn the ones that I know were loving the good and left because I didn't persuade them or their parents of the value of the school. And that's usually only about one kid a year, maybe two. The other three or four, those are the ones I just as soon plan around and let them go. Strategically approach the extracurricular. I know that this is a big issue for, you know, secondary schools in our stage of life, the adolescent stage, I call it. You've got 200 or 300 kids maybe in your school, and you don't know what to do with, or even less, you don't know what to do with extracurricular. You got to strategically approach that. For example, in our school, I highly value team sports versus individual sports, not because I have anything against individual sports. The only sport I was ever good at was skiing, so that certainly isn't a personal value. But team sports make all the difference, especially for boys. So we prioritize them, you know, with boys and team sports, particularly in the junior high. And I hope none of you are Title IX schools, so you can do that. Secondly, make disciples. Remember that's a tough thing to do, but change your teacher's viewpoint. If your teachers look at the world as me teacher, you student, instead of I'm your brother or sister in Christ, and I want to love you and I want to help you, you're not going to build those relationships that hold on to students. Communicate values so that parents hear them. We already talked about that. And create values starting where the parents are. That, I believe, is all the substance that I have for this. And I don't know if I have any time left. Does somebody know when this session is supposed to end? It's noon. Is it right now? Oh, okay. So I've got time for a few questions. I know this is any questions that I can address? Yes. Yes. Oh, no. Yeah, there it is. Am I on the right one there?
Yep.
Yeah, there we go. Yes.
On the those three questions that you had up there that you posted, agree, disagree, or I think the other option was neutral.
Uh-huh.
Do you ask those questions at all during your interview? I don't do it. I'm bored.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Indirectly, I ask a whole series of questions on why, how did you find out about the school, and that leads into what brought you here, what was it that attracted you from our marketing materials, did you see this document, did you see that? It helps me do two things. Are they coming for the right reasons, and what worked, what convinced them? Other questions? Yes. Right. Well, we're just starting that. We haven't really done a lot of it yet. That's one of the things I'm going to talk about tomorrow. The discipleship we've worked on so far has been mostly with students. So organizing, one of the things that we're beginning next year, I'll just give you the one example. Parents aren't going to come to a Learn About Classical Christian Education session. So the idea next year that we're going to be doing is parenting, kind of parenting 101 class. Parents come to those kinds of classes, and a lot of classical Christian education is just, you know, focusing on the parenting stuff. So we use Future Men and things like that to try and work through those, and that's the plan for next year. We had it this year, and I didn't actually get to it. A little building problem, but. Mm-hmm. Yes. So you're doing that now? Okay, so you're doing it. Well, the reason I did 7 sessions is that my trick knee tells me that's how many parents are willing to commit. maybe it's five, maybe it's more, I don't know, but you've got to tell them up front what they're committing to. You don't want an ongoing lesson, an ongoing study. And you can set it every Wednesday night and or Tuesday night or whatever. So that's our plan. But if you're already doing it, I'd be interested in knowing what you're doing. Oh, okay. I was going to say, I'd be worried about not getting the dads, and they're the ones I want to get most, but... Come in for the preview, and then we'll show you the show tonight. Okay, that works. Thank you. That's a good idea. Any other questions, I think? You get off to lunch 5 minutes early. Thank you for coming.